Can music change the world? It's an interesting question. A song may not be able to change a law. It might not be able to fix systemic problems like sexism or racism. But what music can do is bring people together. And once people are together, once people find solidarity and empathy for one another, that can bring about change. Today, you're going to hear a story about how music can break down walls, figuratively and literally. Now, maybe one of the most famous walls ever built was the Berlin Wall. Here's a quick history lesson. After World War II, Germany was divided. The Soviets controlled East Germany, including East Berlin. West Germany became its own country in 1949, but Britain, France, and the USA retained control of West Berlin, deep in Soviet territory. In 1961, the Soviets built the wall to prevent East Germans from fleeing into West Berlin, dividing these two very different worlds. I met Mark Reeder on the street in what would have been West Berlin, near where he first lived when he moved there at the age of 20 in 1978.
So how far would we be right now from the wall if it were still there?
We're about a couple hundred meters.
Really? So you, when you got here, you were pretty close.
I didn't realize that, actually, that I was so... That the wall was just literally down the road, you know. I didn't know that. I didn't really know anything about Berlin, to be honest. When I got here, I realised I knew nothing. The Berlin Wall. I imagined it to be this huge, towering sort of like 25-foot thing, you know. And it wasn't. It was 8 feet, you know.
Yeah, it's not quite as imposing as you'd expect.
It was a bit of a disappointment.
To be fair, he didn't leave his home in Manchester and hitchhike to Berlin for the wall.
But I just came here with the idea I'd come to Berlin, look at the place, go to East Berlin for the day, buy some records and go back home.
And how did
but
it actually
that
go?
Never happened. I came to Berlin and I never left.
Right.
And I've been here ever since.
You could imagine Mark looking almost the same when he was 20 as he does now in his mid-60s. He has an impish gleam in his pale blue eyes. He's quick to mischievously giggle. When I meet him, he's wearing a matching blue custom-made suit, same as he has for years. He looks almost like he's a member of some vague military branch. But actually, he makes music. He produces records. He runs a label. He's always worked in music. And as you might guess about a guy who decides to travel to a different country to buy records, he's got an insatiable curiosity that's contagious. He's the person who brought Joy Division to Berlin for the first time.
I've been waiting for a guy to come and take me by the hand. Cause these sensations make me feel the pleasures of a normal man.
When Joy Division came to Berlin, really, the fascinating thing about Berlin was being able to go up to the buildings and put your fingers in these bullet holes, you know, and look at them and physically feel what this war had scarred this city. And it was really inspirational. You know, Ian wanted to see the Brandenburg Gate from both sides. You know, it had sort of some sort of representation of like this historical kind of Berlin, which kind of affected him. It affected me living here.
It was 1980. At that time, on Mark's side of the wall in West Berlin, you could listen to pretty much anything. On the other side of the wall, not so much. Mark remembers his first trip crossing the wall to East Berlin.
You have to pay to get in because it was like a club, you know. You had to pay to get in. You had to,
the first very exclusive club.
Had the hardest doorman on the planet, you know. You had these guys. They all had no sense of humour, of course, so you couldn't make any jokes.
Mm-hmm.
The nicest pleasantry you could expect was guten Tag, you know. But they'd look at your passport and they'd go scrutinise your passport and photocopy every single page of your passport. And then you'd pay your five German, West German marks to get a day visa. You know, and they'd check everything, go through your bags and your pockets and make you empty everything. And if they were satisfied that you weren't smuggling any kind of magazines or pornography or anything like this, you know, then, yeah, fair enough, you can go for your day trip into our beautiful, glorious capital city.
When they let him through, what he saw kind of blew his mind.
It's just like something being beamed down onto a science fiction set, you know, you beamed down into a completely different world that looks and resembles a lot of your own world in a lot of ways, but it's completely different at the same time. And the cars looked different, the smell of the city was different. People kind of looked virtually the same, they were still humans, you know, but like they were dressed slightly different, and the colours and the quality was really different. And I was kind of fascinated, you know, and I
Absolutely.
Thought, there must be some kind of music scene of sorts here. You know, the first thing I did when I was in East Berlin was look for a record shop, you know, and the record shop was just full of like classical albums and stuff, and East German rock albums. I didn't know any of these artists. It was all, wow, what's this?
See, there's that curiosity again. Mark was hooked. He went back to East Berlin every day for 2 weeks, and he started to make friends there. And some of those friends had caught on to punk music thanks to the radio signals that they were able to pick up from the other side of the wall, but they couldn't get that music any other way. And eventually, Mark decided buying albums from East Berlin wasn't enough. He started smuggling music to East Berlin. And this was a bit tricky. The Ministry for State Security, MFS for short, also known as the Stasi, were always watching. And there was that whole wall you had to get across. Mark started with tapes.
A music cassette is not an easy thing to smuggle. It's like, it's not, I mean, a record is even worse, right? But a cassette is not an easy thing to smuggle because they make lots of noise. So I'd have to prepare the cassette so that it didn't move.
If you could get your hands on one of Mark's smuggled tapes, you could hear popular music in East Berlin. But actually putting on a rock show there, dream on. That seemed impossible. Until Mark was hanging out in a bar in East Berlin with some friends and spotted a man a little ways down from them.
He was very obviously listening to our conversation. At some point, he drank enough to be able to drum enough courage to say, "You're not from here, are you?" You know, and I'm like, "No, I'm from England." And suddenly he changed. It was like someone just turned a light on this guy. Like click. He just kind of went, and he was like, "England!" And it, like, in his wildest imagination, he probably would never have thought he'd ever meet anyone from England in East Berlin. You know, why would anyone want to come here? You know, of their own free will.
Mark and this East Berliner got to talking about music, about Deep Purple and Black Sabbath. They talked about all this British music.
And then he told me that he had an electric guitar, and I thought, it was no big deal, really. But I didn't realize at that moment just how much of a big deal it was.
See, you couldn't just buy an electric guitar in East Berlin. You couldn't pop into a shop for one. No, someone needed to go to Hungary or Czechoslovakia. But that wasn't the only obstacle.
But you needed a permit to own it. You needed a permit to play it.
You had to have a permit to play it?
Yeah, you need a permit. It's an electric guitar. It's like a weapon.
What is this that stands before me?
The state was fearful of about music, and they wanted to control their own music scene in every single aspect. You know, you had your lyrics. If you wrote a song, if you'd already obtained the permission to be in a band, you know, because you had to go and play in front of a group of people, and they would review your abilities as a musician and as an entertainer and whatever. And then they'd kind of like, and then they'd ask you questions like, "Do you write your own material?" "Yes." You know, like, "What? Let me see your lyrics." And then they go through your lyrics and they say, "Yeah, you can't sing that. Sorry, you know, you don't get permission to be a performer. You got to go back to the coal mine."
Oh no!
So the fact that this guy in East Berlin had a guitar to begin with was miraculous. But Mark had a question.
"Where do you play it?" And he's like, "In the church. I play at a blues mass. So I'm not allowed to by law, but the church is this sanctuary inside the state. So I can go there and play Bob Dylan songs and Eric Clapton songs but I'm not allowed to go outside on the street and play those songs. So I was like, blues mass.
Of course, Mark's next question was,
where is it? I write down, go to the church. And I went to the priest and I said, I'd like to do a gig. Is it possible to do a gig here? And he was like, the blues mass is not a gig. It's a church service. You have to pray. And I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. Anything.
Now, Mark had a venue and he had a band. His friends in the Dusseldorf group, Die Totenhosen. Mark knew organizing the gig was risky for his East Berlin accomplices.
Because I said to them, you know, if we do this gig, if we get caught, I'll get kicked out of East Germany and I'll never be able to come and bring your cassettes ever again. But if you get caught, your lives will change completely forever.
Right. For you, as somebody who came...
I'm just a tourist.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I said, like, what you have to make a decision, you have to think about it. You know, do you really want to do this, or you know, do you want to take that risk? And I expected them to go home and think about it, and like they were instantly within about 5 seconds, they went, yes, we want to do it. No, I thought, you have to really think about it. Yeah, we thought about it. We really want to do it.
To make it happen, Mark also had to get the band from West Berlin into East Berlin. He came up with a plan. Cross the border in groups of three so the guards don't get suspicious. Then meet on the other side and split into groups of three again to go to the church.
I said to my friends, I only invite 30 people. When the Sex Pistols played in Manchester in June 1976, only 30 people attended that gig. But what that gig unleashed in the British music scene, punk rock, was a sort of similar kind of thing that I wanted to achieve with this gig in East Berlin.
But could they achieve it? They got the gear and the band and the audience into this church in East Berlin. An impressive feat already, but they still had to play the show.
All the way through the gig, I'm expecting the Stasi to come and kick the door in. And, you know, everyone was really kind of tense because of that, because we thought, we're going to get caught here, right? We're going to get caught. It was like, we're going to be playing for 5 minutes and the door's going to get kicked in and we're going to get caught. As the time ticked away, the realization that we've not been caught yet and that the chances that we're going to get caught before the gig is over, then the feeling in the room changed. And it was really such an exhilarating moment. The relief after when it was over, it was like, wow, we've done something which is completely illegal. It's totally illegal. We've gone against everything the East German state has to throw at us, and we've done an illegal punk rock gig in East Berlin and pulled it off everything. And those kids went and told all their mates, right? The Totenhosen played, and it became this urban myth almost. But what it also did was it inspired all these other wannabe punk rock kids to form a band and go to the church and ask them, can we play in the church, right? So throughout the whole of East Germany, just the mere suggestion really that this had actually happened, it inspired everybody, you know.
The seed had been planted.
Yeah. But it did, yeah, germinate into kind of more than just the punk rock scene. It didn't just kind of like, it didn't just mean something to music, it meant something to the whole general politics.
Mark had thrown the ultimate punk show inside a totalitarian dictatorship, and the punk scene there and that feeling of possibility continued to grow. Mark ended up hosting one more secret Die Totenhosen show at an East Berlin church in 1989, that time attracting 600 people. And later that same year, the wall fell. When the Berlin Wall fell, Mark wasn't even there. He had no idea what was going on. He'd been driving through Poland and Czechoslovakia with some friends, and he didn't find out until 6 days after it happened, when they stopped at a hotel in Hungary for lunch and went up to the reception desk.
And I said, have you got any newspapers? And he was like, I've only got these old newspapers from last week. And he gave me this paper, and it was a picture of a bloke drinking a bottle of champagne on the Berlin Wall, and it said, East German troops tear down wall. And I was looking at this thinking, like, is this some kind of Hungarian kind of satire? Is it something like, yeah, like the National Enquirer of Hungary? And have you got any others? And he went, yeah, I've got another paper. And he gave me another one. It's the same thing in German, yeah. Grenztruppe beginnt Teil am Riss der Mauer. It's like, ugh. And I started reading the news, and I was like, I don't believe it. They've taken down our Disneyland. We've missed it already. The party's it's happened. We've missed it. Just our luck, you know.
Did you feel
the
like...
most historical moment. The thing that we've been waiting for all this time. The thing that we'd all been kind of worked for, you know. I'd worked against this thing, you know. Suddenly we've missed the big party.
But in some ways, the party was just getting started. While we've been talking, Mark and I have been strolling down a street that looks fairly nondescript. There's an H&M store, some office buildings. It looks absolutely nothing like it did when the wall came down in 1989.
This used to be no man's land.
Yeah.
This used to be cordoned off. You couldn't go down here when the wall was up. This was all out of bounds.
No man's land, also known as the Ban Mile, was a strip of land along the wall patrolled by police to stop East Germans from getting near the wall. But when the wall fell, no man's land opened up. Many of the buildings there, which had been untouched since World War II, were abandoned, unsupervised, and for a bunch of young people who like to put on shows, very tempting.
We had the knowledge of what it was like out of our punk scene to put on sort of like small events. Get a generator, a few turntables, and some crates of beer, and you have a party, yeah, you know, smoke machine. Because we'd done like acid house parties in West Berlin and stuff, and there were a few small clubs and things. And East Berlin just, there's nothing here. This is all like wasteland. And so you could make the music as loud as you want, you're not going to affect anybody.
Old bank vaults, abandoned factories, and power stations became techno clubs. Legendary ones like Trezor and VMF and Iverk.
That was the reason why techno became what it is known as today. It was only because of what we have here and what we had here.
Ever on the leading edge of the zeitgeist, that's a German word, by the way, Mark founded his own electronic music label in 1990. In a wink to the Stasi, it's called MFS. But in this case, instead of being short for Ministry of State Security, MFS stands for Masterminded for Success, and it's considered to be the first ever trance label. Punk might have helped bring the wall down, but techno? Hold me back.
It was a free up of everything. It was no longer had the baggage of rock and roll, and it had no longer the baggage of East German, like, controlled music. It was something that was completely free, and it was international. In America, no one was interested. It didn't mean anything. It was just another form of music. But what it meant to the East German kids and the few in the West, that was the thing which made it what it is, because these East German kids could finally choose for the first time in generations, because, like, you know, when Hitler came to power, everything was banned, right? So since 1933, it was the first time that these East German kids could actually make a choice. And it was like, I don't want to listen to, you know, Whitney Houston. I want to have techno. And I want to be able to take ecstasy so I can dance all night. And this feeling of euphoria and feeling of unity. And it didn't matter in this club whether you came from East Berlin or West Berlin or God knows where, anywhere. You know, it didn't matter where you were from. It didn't matter what kind of car you drove, what your education levels were. It didn't matter anything. All it mattered was the music. And that's what made it really special, because everybody was in that room. Everybody was dancing.
Yeah.
that was the feeling of what freedom actually felt like, you know, especially in the first 5 years of the 90s. I'd never felt it since. It was a feeling of freedom of everything, you know, and that was such a luxury, yeah. And I feel so utterly privileged to have been a part of that moment and be able to experience that moment, because unfortunately in this modern age there are a lot of people who don't know what that feeling feels like, and I wish they could experience that one moment like we had here, this opportunity that we had here, to feel what it felt like to be really free.
Feeling of freedom is what Mark has been trying to share with people ever since. Mark continues to make music. He and his collaborator Alanis Chasnow just released an album called, appropriately, Life Everywhere.
If I can just convince one person with what I do to think differently and to be daring and not bothered by what the neighbours think, then I've succeeded, you know. And it's like the music is the vehicle to transport the ideas and the thoughts and everything, because music is forever, you know.
To hear Mark say that while we're standing where the Berlin Wall once was, where he once smuggled tapes and bands across a seemingly impenetrable border, and where later a divided people gathered together again to dance joyously, it's hard not to believe that music can, in fact, change the world. Big, big thank you to Mark Reeder. He joined me for World Cafe's visit to Berlin for our Sense of Place series. You just heard a bit of the title track from Mark's latest album with Alanis Chasnow called Life Everywhere. I'm Raina Duris. Thanks for listening to World Cafe from NPR.